Listen, that's because I've been living in New York, and I would just like to put my own work in that context. Most discourses of modernity are based on theories of progress, modernization, industrialization on the one hand, and neatly and linearly arranged genealogies of high art and culture. Modernity and modernism, by its very nature, had to be obtained by excluding and denying the disruptive and marginal elements that could not easily fit into a game plan. I will not define postmodernism, nor for that matter other terms that inhabit the glossaries of art historical surveys, nor do I want to make easy binary oppositions between modernism and postmodernism, painting and conceptualism and installation, for instance, and mixed media. Because I don't think that the debate should really just be between painting and installation, for instance, because I think, I mean, one of the pertinent questions that I have really is that not all installation is postmodernist, you know, because I think that a lot of people continue to work with a particular modernist way, you know. So I think, you know, those binary oppositions are really not very useful for us to understand, you know, what exactly does the term postmodernist, for instance, mean. Instead, in this paper, I will focus on how form functions within modernity's most naturalized as well as universally disseminated artifact, and that's the photograph. And in relation to my own work and the visual work that follows this paper, that's specifically the family photograph. To do this, I will not directly deal with the postmodernist theories, but will instead go back to early intellectual debates at the turn of the century that engaged with the very same issues we are debating today. That is the problematic of painting in an age of mechanical reproduction. Not so much the empirical data of artworks or ultimately idealist notions of an isolable perception, but instead the phenomenon of the observer. My intention in this paper is to read the role of photography into the discourse of modernism. This I will do by tracing the discourse historically and alluding to the kind of descriptions given to the photograph at the turn of the century. I will refer to Duchamp's Etan Don and a few works from the 1980s. Finally, the focus will be brought to my work, especially the show Looks the Other Way. This was a show I had in New York in January. In regard to work often termed as critique of institutions, a look at the larger context of the public, in quotes, is a point for elaboration. The 1980s saw a conservative onslaught on society and institutions, and alternative politics was easily appropriated and co-opted. This encouraged other areas of philosophical and social articulation to be explored, leading to a tremendous critical engagement with art, art history, and history. New terrains were charted out theoretically. To be more specific, the neo-avant-garde concerns expanded outwards to a conceptual and post-conceptual institutional critique from an initial engagement with the immediate relations between subject and object, viewer and artwork, to the broader constraints and conditions of that relationship. While not quite providing an overview, I would like to show a selection of works which engaged with some of these issues. The squeezing of institutions into becoming conservative bodies prompted an analysis of the nature of the art object, the gallery, and the artist. Naturally, this was a contentious issue, and it drew a number of artists and critics who chose to resist the rapid commodification of work into the fray of hot debate. When can we have the first slide, please? This slide. Yeah, thanks. When Sherry Levine showed her work at a New York art gallery, her work, which as it was read, attempted to provide a critique of modernism by recycling the very same images, those of male artist photographers, such as in this case Walker Evans, bringing into question the authenticity of such work in an age of recyclable consumerist images. If there is any sense in thinking about postmodernism without a knee-jerk reaction of moral purity, then it is because artists, like any other group, are forced to reassess the conditions in which they make their work. And those historical conditions are intricately, I think, associated to issues of form as well as location and audience. So I'll show very quickly a group of slides of work. I'm not going to speak very much about the slides, you know, so it, excuse me, like you feel that it's been taken out of context. Can we have the next slide, please? Sorry. That slide by Hans Haack. Now, what Hans Haack did was he basically brought into the gallery details of corporate sponsorship and the way that, for instance, companies like Philip Morris and Mobil Oil and, the kind of role that they were, had begun to play in the art world and in culture at large, So he, brought in sort of very critical and very sort of cutting, facts and factual information about corporations, for instance, Philip Morris's investments in South Africa in the 80s. Next, please. This is Fred Wilson, who is an African American artist. It's titled High and Low, and it's called Installation View from Primitivism. It's a take after the Primitivism show in New York City, and it's a take off on that. Next, please. This is Jimmy Durham. It's a surveillance camera. No, they're not. I'm just going to go through the photographs and then we'll, I'll just go through the slides. Next, please. This is by an artist called Glenn Ligon. It's called Notes on the Margins of the Black Book. He basically re-photographed Mapplethorpe's photograph and represented it at the Whitney Museum with quotations from different black writers, such as James Baldwin, for instance. Next, please. This is Carrie Mae Weems. It says Carrie Mae Weems appropriated sort of common popular nursery rhymes and jokes, for instance, and put them onto photographs. This one says, looking into the mirror, the black woman asks, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the finest of them all?" The mirror says, "Snow White, you black bitch, and don't forget that." Next, please. "Your gaze hits the side of my face." That's by Barbara Kruger. It's all right, we can just move on. The next one. Have the next one. We'll just move on. We'll put the lights on. "Your gaze hits the side of my face." That's by Barbara Kruger. Can you have the lights, please? Sorry about the slides. I thought I'd put them in order. See, the historical connection in this work is related to Habermas's view of the bourgeois public sphere as social formation, which functions in opposition to the absolutist state, and it is tightly bound to this model of the new bourgeois subject emerging from the familial interior, a consciousness functionally adapted to the institutions of the public sphere in the world of letters. This public sphere, in its conception and its classical liberal bourgeois guise, was partial and narrowly based and was constituted from a field of conduct, contested meanings, and exclusions. The first strand of institutional critique takes as its task the material analysis of the perceptual protocols the museum uses to disguise or naturalize what is in fact the historical bourgeois subject. Can we have both machines on? I just the next slide. Just keep the lights on. Can you just move to the next slide? Yes. You can just turn that off. Here I will insert Duchamp's Attendant in relation to its presence in the museum and the kind of intervention he might have been calling for at the end of his artistic career. It is the institutional setting, the great museums of the West, that are part of the development of the 19th, 20th century culture. The museum was constructed around the shared space of a sense of the visual, grounded in the possibility of individual subjects forming a community. Yet it is this system that Attendant attempts only to disrupt by making it strange. This is a piece at the Philadelphia Museum. It's one of Duchamp's last pieces. The construction provides an interpretation of the carnal rather than the conceptual in Rosalind Krauss's terms, as it views the body as a psychophysiological system. It was the stopping at the analytical, at the analytic process, at the retina, the making of the nerve endings that comprised of Duchamp's critique of modernism. One of Duchamp's essential critiques of the language of modernism was his critical attitude towards the visual. He saw himself as being anti-retinal, open instead to the matters that are conceptual, and the world of ideas would be seen in opposition to the retinal or the visual as retina versus gray matter. He didn't believe that pure painting was interesting in itself. For me, he said, the goal is something else. It is a combination of at least an expression that only gray matter can succeed in rendering. Here the relationship of the viewer to the work. You can put the next slide on a bit. The next one, please. No, it's okay. I'll just keep going. Yeah, I just wanted to show you through the peephole. No, it's all mixed up. You just turn that off, I think. Photography's position in modernism is a complex one. I'm going to just. Can you have the lights on, please? Photography's position in modernism is a complex one, where it has depended both on its presence and its absence. Here, with the help of Benjamin's essay, A Short History of Photography, Christian Metz's Photography and Fetish, and Bazin's Anthology of the Photographic Image, I will attempt to give meaning to the photograph. The invention of photography itself overturned the judgment seat of art, and much of modernism found this hard, and hence the need to repress the fact. In a sense, postmodernism constitutes a return of the repressed. Postmodernism, thus, in its critical incarnation, represents a breach with modernism, with those institutions that are preconditions for shaping the discourse of modernism. The institutions include the museum, art history, photography, etc. The photographic work of the 1980s that could be termed postmodernist refers to artists who approach the question of representation through photographic modes, particularly all those aspects of photography that have to do with reproduction, with copies and copies of copies. The peculiar presence of this work is affected through absence, through its unbridgeable distance from the original, from even the possibility of an original. Such presence is what I attribute to the kind of postmodernist photographic activity. It is not dialectically in opposition to modernism, but it is the return of the repressed, of aspects that modernism chose to exclude. Photography's advantage from the very beginning is in the absence of the presence of the human being. The photographic image is the object itself, the object freed from a condition of time and space that governs it. The photographic image becomes distinctly a medium apart from painting. It is that very area that Benjamin labeled aura in the work of art, essay, which postmodernist work has no dialogue with, which is what modernist art historians preserve as they sift out false copies from authentics to be preserved and adorned on the walls of the museum. The presence of the artist must be detectable. That is how the museum knows it has something authentic. Walter Benjamin's point about the aura is that it depletes with the mechanical reproduction of images, except for those few images at the beginning of photography's history, and those included two aspects, which was the long exposure time during which the subjects grew, as it were, into the images, and the unique unmediated relationships between photographers, who were the technicians of the later school, and the sitter who was a member of a class of the ascendant replete with an aura that penetrated to the folds of his bourgeois overcoat and bow tie. Thus the aura is no longer in the hands of the photographers, but in the hands of the subject, whose images is magically preserved through the workings of the mechanical apparatus and the photographic paper's interactions with chemicals and light. The unmistakable hand of the painter, which imbues it with its value, authenticity, and aura, is absent. By reading Benjamin's essay through the work of postmodernist photographer-artist, Douglas Crimp points out that by cropping, fragmenting, blowing up, fictionalizing of already existing stereotypes turns the notion of the aura in the Benjaminian sense on its head by evoking absence rather than presence, in that the aura is acquired by severing from an origin, from an originator, from authenticity. The aura is then synonymous with ghost. Let us now look at this piece of silent rectangular paper, the mirror with the memory. Extracting fragments on some characteristics of the photograph can function more effectively as fetish. The possibility of a lingering look, etc., makes it more likely to work as fetish. Its social use means it is accessible to ordinary people. Photography's enjoyment of a high degree of social recognition is in another domain, that of the presumed real of life, mostly private and family life, birthplace of the Freudian fetish. A kinship between photography and privacy remains alive and strong as a social myth. In psychoanalysis, the fetish is related to death through the terms of castration and fear. Photographic off-frame space is subtle. The characters off-frame will never come into the frame, will never be heard again. It is another form of death. The spectator cannot help imagining some off-frame hallucinating, dreaming the shape of this emptiness. This off-frame character, by its absence inside the rectangle of paper, reminds us of the feeling of lack in the Freudian theory of the fetish. Here, castration is what defines lack. This myth of the fetish, as defined by Freud as that which attempts to recuperate the lack experienced by the fear of castration, is what can be defined as the founding myth of our emotional modernity. Photography is more capable of itself becoming a fetish. This fetish has then, in the case of the family photograph, to be seen to be connected inextricably to the structure of the family in the modern world, proof of family unity and at the same time an instrument of or tool to affect that unity. Photography is most frequently nothing but the reproduction of the image that a group produces for its own integration. Through absolute faith, the family unit stamps the photograph with patent of realism. Society does nothing but confirm itself in the tautological certainty that an image of reality that conforms to its own representation of objectivity is truly objective. Now I'm going to sort of go into my own work and show you our work. And I mean, I know it's been a bit fragmented, but I hope that, you know, my own work can be seen through what I've described here, you know, in relation to photography. There were many aspects which fascinated me with these images I found in my grandmother's trunks. While reframing, I embark on a journey that is essentially autobiographical by re-photographing and maintaining the essential structures of the images, yet coloring to enhance that. I can leave it as it is. Which is obviously missing in these sepia-laden images. Yeah, we can leave it at that.
I attempted to both create a subjective fiction at the same time through the knife-like process of cutting and reframing, preserving the already existing structures apparent in the images. We have the next. Next, yeah. She looks the other way. A title reframes. It acts as the framer of the object, suspended in space. It forces relationships to be made at the conceptual level between the words read on the wall in a gallery and between the purely retinal or oral. The title of the show needs a little elaboration. The title of the show was Looks the Other Way, and this particular work is called She Looks the Other Way. And I will do this through a series of images, a work within the show. The title of this piece genders the meta-title and draws the disparate objects on display into the specific concerns in the piece. This gendering of the title is crucial, as the definitions I have provided are definitions, that's the earlier definitions I gave on photography, are given by the voice of male authority. Rather than describe colonial photography in India and provide a critique of the colonialist project, I would like to push the context and history of it by bringing to the front some of the relationships evident in the images, those of the Western and Indian women. The relationships, though grounded in history, the histories of conversion, of subtle and overt civilizing attempts, have an aspect often not explored enough, and that would include the personal relationships and the agency of women who negotiated their identities in a tumultuous century. While the image aids in helping to define those relationships, it also affects in naturalizing them, in glossing over conflict. The form of the images becomes an important part of the way we process them. This can be done through reading critically women's presence within this silent rectangular form and charting out a feminist interpretation. Some of the choices taken in selecting the images was governed by the need to explore masculinity and femininity in these naturalized, ostensibly naturalized images. But when I say that, I do not mean there are only two poles, just male and female to be examined, but because these were heightened differences constructed in the 19th century. Can we go back one image? This is a letter called A Letter from Grandmother. My darling granddaughter, the lady with the hat is Mrs. Andrews. My father came to the Lord Jesus through her husband, and they were real good missionaries, Scottish missionaries. My father was in Chingalpatt studying in the mission high school when he became a Christian. They will not accept him into the house, but his mother gave his food in the veranda, and he slept there. One day he went in the night to the temple and turned the idol upside down and came. Next day there was a great shouting and cursing when the priest went in and saw. He said, "Whoever did it will become blind by the evening." Nothing happened. So my father told his mother he did it to prove that if the idol had power to correct itself, it will be God. It did not, but Jesus had power, and he is almighty. So this particular work, you know, was handmade. I actually physically, with Letraset, put every letter onto this glass surface. It took me, over 2 months, but it was like the first works I did, which really, got me in this direction of looking at, or interpreting these images. Can we have the next image? Framed cinematically, this image is of a group of Indian men and women with a Western woman who is delicately positioned in the camera's frame, yet out of frame in that her gaze is shifted away from the camera to point outside of the frame of the image. Young and fragile, with a somewhat enigmatic look on her face, her white body and white dress merge with the exposed surface of the image, spilling out of its contours into the other members of the group photograph. Yet she looks the other way. She is barely engaged in being there. By keeping the framing on her, I panned across the image, keeping her in focus and making her displaced gaze the focus of the viewer, by which another undetermined perspective is brought into the meaning of the image. In more than one respect, Our Lady in White disrupts the conventions of the group photograph. Within the highly conventionalized arrangement of the photograph, she defies that moment when the camera is clicked by the photographer, tearing herself apart from the members of the group who intently and expectantly gaze ahead at the camera. As evident in the dictionary meaning of the term, terms that load the title, looks the other way, look another seem to imply the historical linking together of techniques of seeing and of vision with that of studying or looking at the other racially and culturally. As colonialism, anthropology as a study, and photography all emerge about the same time, looking at the other and looking the other way are both implied in the title as a metaphorical doubleness. While the title attempts to embody this doubleness, the image transfers doubleness, as in double consciousness, to the Western woman with the hat. It is her gaze directed elsewhere that becomes the point of fascination and enigma. Splitting up the surface of the images, that is, the whole of the image, is also an attempt to find other points in the classic perspectival relationship that the photograph subjects have with the camera and the cameraman. Looks the other way points to both the history of the one-point perspective as well as to the possibility of multiple perspectives. In looking at the photographs, the relationship of the subjects with the viewer influenced my decision to fragment the image to create new narrative relationships. Since the first work I did around the subject was with the letter from grandmother, an account of the way her father converted to Christianity and attempted to break the news to his parents, the idea of conversion, the changing or transformation of one's identity, also brought a meaning into looking the other way. While essentially double consciousness is given to the postcolonial subject, the other, negotiating modernity from two points, here the doubleness lies with the Western woman who shifts her head away from the central and unified look of the camera to a point unknown to the viewer and not documented. What was she looking at then moves from being a question about the actual subject of her displaced gaze to being a philosophical one of what other perspectives were possible outside of this classical perspective. It is at this juncture that a sense of loss can be hypothetically implied, religious conversion, and conversion from the real into an image, that is, technological conversion. Once this conversion has been undertaken, then the identity or representation explodes into numerous possibilities. There is an implied multiplicity in the reinvention. We'll just go through the slides. Can we have the next slide, please? On both sides. The title of this work is The Doll. This is one fragment which I then repeated in five images, changing the hues of the color. This work was actually done on a computer, and it was possible for me to change the colors quite easily. I then shot it off the computer and then blew them up. Each image is about 20 inches by 24. Next, please. The image on the right is called Eyes, and this one is called Boots. The one on the right hand side is Boots, and the one on the left hand side is the Eyes. Next, please. I actually first made the work on the right-hand side. That was the first work I did after Letter from Grandmother. And I just sort of wrote on these images in a sense to really sort of, direct the kind of interest I was taking in these images. One says, they face the backs of the group. The group has its back to them. The camera captures both, puts them on the same plane, transforms reality without doubling it. This image is about 20 by 40 inches. It's quite large. This is also part of the artist book, as the previous image was. And this says, I can't discern the look, nor look into the eyes, nor have the eyes look out at me, reveal the faces blurred with time. This one has the image repeated four times. The first image has passive written across it with a question mark, the second negative. The third has nothing on it, and the fourth interrogative with a question mark. And the one on the right-hand side is an image from another artist's book in which the image begins to pixelate, and I've inscribed presence, present. This is also part of that artist's book, and it says, wrapped in the unstitched garment, bound by yards of cloth, limitless as it twirls around the body and the folds and creases made around the unpredictable contours, the seated figures, their legs crossed nervously like a double helix. On the right-hand side, you see a series of, I made a series of postcards. I further fragmented these images and just took, in this case, just the suits and the boots and basically the accoutrements of clothing from the subjects in the images. You see the book being displayed in the installation, and that's a postcard. On the postcard, the postcards had little blurbs. This one says, she decided to alter all her blouses. They soon covered her stomach and neck and had lace sewn along the edges. This is from the image of the doll. It's just the fragment of the doll. And it says, she stared longingly at the doll's eyes and was heartbroken when the voice string broke. You can turn this off just on the right, on the left-hand side. This is another project that I've just begun doing. It's an artist book. It's the images from a news item which was titled Dry Run. I saw it in the front line. And it's basically about the suicide bomber who killed Gamini Dissanayake in Sri Lanka. I think it was October 94. And I've just begun this work. It's sort of work in progress. And I'll just show it to you. It's a poem that goes with each image. It says, she held her head high above the crowds. She remembered being a child. Her memory flashed back and then withdrew into the ominous present, clasping onto her handbag, its gold-coated chain, sweating in her palms. Okay, this continues from that work. The police worked all night with the surgeon, piercing, piecing, embodying, infusing her electrifying look, and yet in the image, photographed and published off the screen. Next, please. There is a buzz in her ear that feels electronic and melts into the screeching noise of the microphones, and her head feels it might explode. They called it dry run when they rewound the tapes. She looks alive in death, as though her body might represent the death she desired, in its inanimate form, like an object to be handled, to be looked at, to be admired, to be despised, to become a trophy of a symbolic act. She held her own head high. Yeah, we'll stop here. I'll just go through these. I mean, these are the postcards, and then the next one. These are just other fragments of the installation. Basically, I recycled other materials into the installation. The dolls are the plaster casts of dolls that I just collected in the marketplace. But basically, I was trying to sort of link up the dolls in the images and then make sort of physical manifestations of those of the dolls in the that you see in the photographs. And above it, you see the balcony, which, again, I just physically sort of cast in paper. Basically, it just sort of played off each other, so that the fragments sort of became, they were reduced, the photograph was reduced to, the most basic fragment, and then those fragments were then replicated in different materials. Next, please. Yeah, that's it. There's just one other piece that is going to be played on a tape recorder. We have the lights. Can we play the tape?
I peer into it from its glass window. The space is fascinating to her. A deep shop, filled with furniture, designed like old furniture, specifically colonial furniture, and if from large bungalows that sprawled across large properties and were surveyed by a service club. Having observed the shop carefully from its tall glass windows, a few days later I went back to the shop to ask permission to market, and I think that she caught the eye of a shopkeeper busy with his morning chores. I felt like I was asking permission to commit a crime.
Reluctant to give in to her demand, she was expected to bring examples of her work to show him. What would she do with these images? She tried to explain, but not very convincingly, that she only photographed for herself and she has a fascination for colonial furniture.
I'm aware of the reflection of myself in the open mirror.
This is I.
Outside the strange and magic images of life in the plantation, smiling faces, rifles in hand.
I am I.
And again looking ahead that it has legitimacy in the camera pointed at it.
And she overhears him telling one of his customers that the furniture is all new, but that they are all made from old designs. She looks around while his customers move languidly from chair to chair and bed to bed, lying, trying them out, inquiring about the prices.
The small world.
Yeah, we can turn it off.
I come across this shop, its window barely lit, and the banner.
Yeah, I should just explain a little bit about this piece. It's just a sound piece that I did, and it's based on being a voyeur into a shop that exists in Soho, and it's called British Khaki. And basically, there are all these shops that sort of sell old colonial nostalgic furniture and other things from colonial era. So it's just like a reflection on what it means to sort of walk past this shop, as it were, sort of window shopping, and what are the emotions and the issues that come up.
I just like your reflection, maybe at least some hint as to which direction one might go, because you are clearly at least the impression I got was that both your presentation and some of the cutting of the photograph plays out this whole theme of the denigration of the eye, and the denigration of EYEI, not I. So that at one level, the entire point of exchange between the glances between the viewer and the looking out at the world from the pictorial space seems to say something about the nature of framing. But I wasn't very clear as to what exactly or how you would move in that kind of direction. Because clearly, let's say you're not using, even the mirror is not a Lacanian kind of mirror. It's not defining me in that sense. So I'd like a little more elaboration about how you put this entire question about the exchanges which don't really happen. And to that extent, part of it is a playing out of the thing about about the fragmentations in mirrors and so on. But I couldn't put the different things together. So partly because it was a very complex paper, but maybe you can tell us a little more on.
I think basically, seems a little jumping. So it's because when I first started this work about 5 years ago, I think, I was sort of more interested in sort of how one would extract, say, the history out of these images, So then I did a lot of kind of historical research, sort of going to the archives and going to sort of just looking into the specificity of that history. And then as it sort of grew, I just had, one of the things that I did in this work is I sort of looked at history, for instance, and then did a lot of research, and then put all this research that I did and the notebooks into a box, and then moved away from it. Then I sort of found that I needed to explore another element of it. And it went on like this. And in fact, when I say that I opened this trunk of photographs and took them out, I actually in the process I was filling up other boxes of things, information of, I Xeroxed them large, I would paint over them, I would just do different things with them, and then just kind of move on and reject them altogether. I think finally at the end, I really felt that I needed to sort of get back to form, to issues of form,
explaining what it was that this, because I think when we, I think the photograph is not talked about very much, and I think, you know, that there are these issues of form that are not dealt with, at least, you know, in the discourses that I've been part of. And so there was this need for me to recuperate a lot of it and not to just sort of give it historical meaning or social. So I, and then, of course, once the fragmentation had taken place, then I had to recuperate that and sort of build on another kind of, you know, sort of formal. But I think it sort of hinges on various things, you know. So I don't think it's, so I think there is that, you know, that especially in the installation, there was this kind of multiple aspect to it. And it didn't sort of push any one thing, you know. It sort of fragmented images and then it replicated other things like, you know, the plaster cast of the dolls, you know. There's, in some ways, I think, you know, like my interest now is more of an academic interest, you know, of like how to, you know, how do you sort of, you know, sort of actually talk about history and talk about social issues and talk about politics and still maintain kind of, you know, these problems of form, you know. I mean, so that it is ultimately an aesthetic problem or it is linked to that, but that how would one sort of incorporate it? And, you know, I've been resisting sort of making a film or something because I think that would be the sort of, you know, that would actually solve some of the problems that I face. Like the sound piece, for instance, has also been another fragment, you know. I haven't put it all together. But I don't know if that answers anything. But
okay. If I were to push that a little further, I mean, I would say that in a way, if you are receiving yourself from those images, then, and if you're following on the Lacanian kind of line, then in some ways, the danger of the mirror is, of course, that I imagine myself as if there was something called a whole. But of course, that's completely a false gift, you know, from the mirror. Which is why it seemed to me that, I'm not saying this is the only direction, but it came across to me at least that the part of the academic and the aesthetic, which in a certain sense came together, was the question really of fragmentation in relationship to the eye. So that, I mean, you're not taking the final step of saying, and I hope you don't in a way, that, you know, that you then get some kind of a naming through which that whole can be done. Mm-hmm. But that's the direction in which I would say that.
So I haven't articulated it, but I think it comes back to sort of the way that, in a way, I become like a voyeur, and, you know, so that I also position myself as the viewer onto this work, you know, so that I don't, it's no longer the viewer in terms of the audience of the work, but that I myself have like inserted myself as, you know, the viewer onto these images, and then slash, in many ways, the voyeur, because, you know, the kind of self-conscious relationship that I've developed with my grandmother and with, you know, the very personal, means that I've had to distance myself from it and sort of look at it, you know, from, I think it was only possible because I went away and quite far away, and that, you know, that in some ways is what I'm trying to get at also.
Yeah.